I view AI as an accelerant today versus a replacement. Over time, I think it will be able to do a lot more. But again, it's like fuel on the fire, and humans have to control where to best apply that fire, all the rationale and logic, but definitely a big accelerant.
Welcome to another episode of our Traction Podcast. This is The Next Wave. The Next Wave is a different take on our podcast where we're bringing back some of our most favorite guests that have either graced our stage or joined our podcast 10 years ago, 5 years ago. And we're going to revisit their topics to see, do they still hold up in today's world of AI? Traction is brought to you by LaunchAcademy.ca, one of Western Canada's main tech hubs and an international accelerator program that provides you access to the Canadian Startup Visa, as well as Boast.ai, your go-to partner for R&D tax credits.
We're back with another episode of the Next Wave podcast. Today's guest is Brian Rothenberg. He is a VC with DeFi.pc and a great guest from Traction's past. He was on our stage in 2017. He has a distinction of having one of our most popular talks in 2017, but also his video on our YouTube channel has well over 100,000 views. Brian, welcome back to Traction.
Thanks, Ray. It's great to be back and I really appreciate it. I had a fun on stage and now it's great to revisit things here.
All right, I'm going to get through your bio here. Brian is a partner at early stage venture capital DeFi VC. Previously, Brian held leadership roles through every stage from founding all the way through IPO. Most recently, Brian was at Event for 6+ years from startup through public company, serving as a VP of growth and running a 100+ million revenue line as GM. Brian founded a VC-backed startup, SkillSlate, which was acquired by TaskRabbit, which eventually was acquired by IKEA. Brian has also been an angel investor and advisor to dozens of startups as part of Sequoia Capital Scout Program, First Run Capital's Angel Track and Export Network, and Y Combinator's Growth Council. Brian, give us a little bit about DeFi. What are you guys doing at DeFi?
I shifted from the founder operator path where I'd spent over a decade to full-time investing. And so I've been on the team at DeFi for 6 years now. We're an early stage venture firm. We tend to lead or co-lead rounds from pre-seed, seed, and Series A is the core of where we focus. We've raised about $700 million so far over the course of three funds. We're investing out of a $300 million vehicle right now. You know, really focus on a bunch of different areas. We're generalists by focus area. But each of us as partners have areas that we go deeper. I spend a lot of time in marketplaces, as you might expect, but also AI, vertical AI, vertical SaaS, enterprise, you name it, we do it. We tend to follow great founders and just look to back them as they're getting going. All of the partners here on our team have been former operators and or founders, and we have pretty deep venture roots as well. So that's a little bit about us. Let me know if you have any questions.
You're based in the Bay Area. Everybody's talking about that resurgence. Everybody's back in the Bay Area, and AI is obviously leading that charge. What are you seeing there locally? What's hot? What's got you excited?
Yeah, it's really great. It's really returned from the COVID depths. I'm a Bay Area native, so I have a lot of love and passion for the Bay Area. It was tough seeing it go through the COVID downturn, and a lot of people were questioning, is it going to come back? How strong are the network effects actually? And what we've seen is, I'd say over the last 2 years, and specifically like in the last year, it has really resurged. Like we have a new San Francisco office. There's a ton of activity. Can't go for a walk around their office without bumping into 3 to 5 entrepreneurs and other investors that we know. So the density is really there and there's a lot of excitement. This wave of AI, like if you're a builder in AI, the Bay Area, I think is the best place to be. Just again, the density of talent, network and opportunity that exists. So it's been amazing to see it come back to life and it really feels vibrant in a way that I haven't felt previous since the prior boom pre-COVID.
Yeah, even I'm inclined to spend not just weeks but months in the Bay Area because of just that density and the opportunity. And it's not just the big events, like there's small little meetups, little get-togethers, private dinners and things like that. There's just so many opportunities to connect with like-minded people. And one of the terms I heard is you're in an environment of velocity. You're with people that are pushing the envelope, moving really fast. And I don't think you get that without that density there.
No, like I always tell this story. When I was a founder of my last company, I was with my co-founder and we were in a Starbucks, like regrouping after an investor meeting. And we were working through this really tough problem that we were having in the marketplace. And we're talking out loud about it. And the guy next to us in the Starbucks leans in and he's, I'm a former YC founder. I had a marketplace company. We ran into that same problem. Here's how we thought about solving it. And it was like this click and it was totally serendipitous, right? What are the chances the guy next to us hears that and chimes in and helps us. But that speaks to the density and some of the magic that is San Francisco and the Bay Area.
Yeah, there's no place like it. I literally travel around the world, visit startup communities around the world, and people are trying to replicate SF. But yeah, there's just something there that you just can't replicate. And I think a lot of it has to do with that density of people that are there.
For sure.
All right, we're going to jump into our conversation about marketplaces and what's evolved since 2017 when you first graced our stage. Format for Next Wave, we have clips from your talk that we're going to showcase, and you and I are just going to dive into it and see what's resonated, what was right, what was wrong, what's changed, and what the future holds. So let's cue our first clip.
Frequently, a novel approach or some kind of hack can help to roll up the supply side. So this is a startup that I founded in the local services space. And what we did at the time, this was about 2009, we crawled the web classifieds listings. So a lot of independent service professionals didn't have a website yet. They weren't on Yelp. They didn't have their own website, but they were posting frequently to Craigslist and other temporary classified sites. We'd crawl the web. We'd use technology to structure the data and categorize them by vertical. And then we use Amazon Mechanical Turk to help to answer questions like, what area do they work in? And how much do they charge per hour? And what are their specialties? And we built their first websites, published them to the web, and invited them to claim to augment their information. It was a highly effective way to start to roll up the supply side, but it hadn't been done before.
All right. First off, Brian, you got that Paul Rudd magic going on. You looked exactly the same as you're doing it.
It's a big compliment. I appreciate it. Now in my 40s. Thank you.
And so in that video, you're talking about web crawlers, Mechanical Turk as tools to build up the supply side of a marketplace. So when you're launching a marketplace, there's the demand side, people that want to use the products or services, and then the supply side, people that are providing that. Yeah. And this was a hack to build up the supply side because it's chicken and egg. If you don't have people providing services or products, nobody wants to come to the site. So you got to game it somehow. How has that evolved? Are people still using Mechanical Turk? Are there new solutions? Like I myself am building an AI marketplace and we're using AI generated data to build up some content, but also synthetic data to test and validate. What are some of the new hacks and tools? Or is it still right back to web crawlers and Mechanical Turk?
Yeah, so I feel like that clip dates me a little bit. Like at the time or at the time we were doing it, it felt pretty cutting edge. Not many people were using Mechanical Turk and it was a creative solution that we thought at the time. Obviously, that was pre-generative AI, like taking data from the web, generating profiles for service providers on their behalf that they could claim, using other humans to do micro tasks to complete those profiles. Novel at the time, but now all that can be done with AI. And web crawling is very prominent still. A lot of AI-related companies are crawling the web to get data. I think there will be a lot of implications and probably some tightening down there over time. But generative AI, I think, unlocks a lot of creative hacks. You can do effectively the same strategy that we did back then, but using generative AI at a much lower cost and probably a much higher quality and consistency. I think it's a great time to be an entrepreneur. I still think finding a novel hack in a marketplace to either grow the supply or demand side. You mentioned earlier, you have to have products on the shelves. So I still think generally leading with the supply side first approach makes sense, but really applying automation and AI to whichever side of the marketplace is most constrained and needs a little bit of greasing of the wheels. I can go a long way today and it's pretty exciting to see.
And in that video, you touched on a tactic of putting a person's profile or putting a company up on your site prior to them, not them doing it themselves, but you're taking the initiative, putting it up there and then say, hey, look, you're on our site. People want to use your product. Come and claim our page. Is that still a tactic? Are people still taking the initiative to put the service providers or products into their marketplace ahead of the first engagement with that person?
Yeah, I think it's a balance of finding the right amount of friction to get the network participants to participate. And so our thesis in that was it feels very overwhelming for a service pro who's out in the field doing services, et cetera, to sit down, create their own profile. It may take them an hour, et cetera. So can we just get them started and reduce the barrier to a point where if they have a starter profile and they can click to claim it and just finish out or correct any imperfections, that it would convert at a higher level. And there was also the benefit that we actually would start sending demand or people who were looking to book to these professionals before they maybe even claimed. So that carrot of here's a new job, that was often a pretty powerful hook to pull them in and get them to activate more or less. I still think that exists. I think, again, the we found that the quality went up greatly. Like, you can't just book somebody who's not engaged on the platform. Getting them to do the basic amount of work and have them buy into the platform was still important. But again, lowering the initial barrier and getting them to progressively add more, make their profiles better as they saw more and more value, it was a pretty worthwhile strategy. And we've seen that happening today across other categories in other contexts. Oftentimes now it's the generative AI creating these starter profiles or the seed set of content or data, but definitely still a viable strategy.
And I think it's also, so you get them 90% there, say, hey, come and claim your profile. I think it's lost on a lot of people. These are small businesses, and I've owned small businesses myself. Like, you are inundated with so many responsibilities. You're the CEO, you're the CTO, you're the CFO, you're the janitor, you're the HR person. So you've got all these hats to wear, and now I got to take on marketing, business development as well. So if you're able to get them 90% there, say, hey, this is your profile, take it on. And I think what I've seen and what you just touched on is you have generative AI. So that person may not like the profile that's up there and they don't have the time to try to write a copy, but hey, there's a generative AI button, say, hey, let me write it for you.
Yeah.
And you're seeing that more and more in different applications where, hey, let our AI fill in the information for you, or here's our suggestion, or you can use Grammarly and it fixes your grammar. So it just makes their life simpler and easier to get to that end point of, I just need more business. I need more people to use my product.
For sure. And I think as technologists, we may think, oh, generative AI, it's out there, it's accessible. But maybe for small businesses that haven't played around with it yet, making it more consumable, easier to use in their context, like by starting them out. And then I liked what you said, maybe there are tools like a button like, hey, don't like your description that we tried for you, regenerate, or write a quick 2-sentence summary and we'll make it more robust. But I think there are ways to create almost like training wheels to onboard more people to use AI in a way that serves their businesses and helps them.
Yeah. And I think, like, you touched on another thing. As technologists, we probably thinking 20 steps ahead of what actually is relevant to that small business owner. We're thinking, okay, you can get your own, you can build your own app with AI. You can have this type of user experience and these customer follow-ups, build a whole funnel. Whereas they just need a tool to help them write copy.
Yeah.
Or I'm not a good photographer. I don't know how to take pictures. Take a simple picture and your AI will generate 20 different options for you to use as your product image. Simple things like that, that just, again, as a small business owner, somebody that was formerly an accountant, that's now a baker trying to run a bakery and showcase the croissants that they're making, just having AI to be able to generate awesome ad copy that they can use in Instagram ads and stuff, that's a game changer for them. Whereas for us, we're thinking, you can have an app that's going to give you this great user experience. No, I don't need that. I just need somebody to help me make great ads.
For sure. And this ties to another trend that we're seeing with AI, being that where people have typically paid to use software, right, on a SaaS-based model, there is a trend towards more products and services charging on a per outcome basis. So if you know your end target customer, you understand their pain points and what outcome, what solution they need in the end, you can charge them on a variable basis on the output, you know, the problems that you're solving for them. So it creates a new, interesting usage-based, outcome-based pricing model that actually, if you deeply understand your customers, it can make it actually lower friction for them to adopt, because they only pay when the outcome is a solution that they need.
Yeah. And again, AI's doom and gloom is going to take jobs, but because you have AI doing the work, you can actually build in those type of models, because you're no longer burdened with hourly wages or monthly salaries on these individuals that you need to cover the cost somehow. But if AI is doing the work, if it's automated, that business model of, you know, you're only going to pay per usage or pay per outcome is actually viable.
Definitely.
All right, we're going to jump to our next clip. And this is along the same track around marketplaces. Building things that don't scale. That's something that we've heard lots of times, and you reference this in your talk. Let's jump to the clip.
We sold our business to TaskRabbit, and it was a pretty good outcome, but Thumbtack is now $1 billion-plus valuation company, and their approach to building up the supply side and local services was to crawl the web as well, but they built out a 300-person team in the Philippines to actually manually email a lot of these service providers, invite them on the platform, engage in a dialogue if those service pros had any questions. And ultimately, I would say their approach in the long run was much more successful. Reid Hoffman, founder of LinkedIn, once said, the only way to scale is to do things that don't scale. And I think that's sometimes true, especially in building marketplaces.
So again, we talked about AI, generative AI, and all these new tools. Is that still relevant to build things that don't scale? With AI, can you not make everything scale?
I think you can't make everything scale yet. At some point, you probably will, but you can sure do a whole lot more than you used to be able to do. Like the whole premise of Thumbtack building a 300 or 500 person team in the Philippines to just brute force the network and make matches and get these profiles created is crazy in today's world, right? Because now you could use generative AI for probably, I would guess, 80 to 90% plus of those tasks. Having that in your pocket today as an entrepreneur, whereas, gosh, previously you had to literally travel. I remember Jonathan Swanson, the founder of Thumbtack, he would go travel to the Philippines to manage his team, get them going, spent so much time on it. And it was a huge cost and overhead that goes away with generative AI. I still think you have to do things that don't scale. I still think that there is a place for human touch, and AI is great, but it has not yet gotten to the place of replacing humans. And I'll use an example. I'm an investor in a marketplace business called Safara. It's a travel site focused on Gen Z and millennials, trying to create a cooler, more unique brand for that audience and doing some other interesting things behind the scenes. But a key part of their value prop is they are really tastemakers and in the know. So they curate local hotels to stay at, things to do in local areas. And now AI can enhance a lot of that process, but it is still humans in the loop, humans doing it who know that, and that provides a better experience to end customers. So again, it's like a, you have to brute force things and apply a human centric angle, because humans that are the end consumers really want that. It can't be all AI, but AI can really unlock a lot of things that didn't exist before or cost a tremendous amount more to do.
Yeah. So again, 300 person team might drop down to 30, but those 30 are each using AI agents and they're getting 10x the work out of it. But you still need a human on the receiving end of the outputs of the AI to determine, is this right? Is it accurate? Is this relevant to the instance or the current situation I have to apply that output?
That's right. I view AI as an accelerant today versus a replacement. Over time, I think they will be able to do a lot more, but again, it's like fuel on the fire and humans have to control where to best apply that fire, all the rationale and logic, but definitely a big accelerant.
Okay. The next flip is still in reference to marketplaces, but it's the marketing around the marketplaces and how to leverage upvotes and positive sentiment to get traction and word of mouth as opposed to doing paid advertisements. So let's jump to the clip and we're going to dive into how that's relevant today.
Another tactic in marketplaces that I love is getting your customers, which is typically the supply side, to promote your brand, which can be worth more than 1,000 marketing campaigns. I'm sure many of you have seen these, the famous Yelp stickers about people love us on Yelp, Instacart's branded grocery bags, TaskRabbit's logoed shirts, etc. This is great offline evangelism of a brand, and if you can build that into how the service works, even better. There are also online examples. So here you have Eventbrite's ticket widget embedded in third-party sites. You have OpenTable's reservation widget embedded in others. If you can use vanity, like the Thumbtack examples here, saying, hey, I'm a top service professional, that vanity can go a long way in getting people to evangelize your brand, which again is extremely powerful.
So today, probably the most relatable score or evaluation that people can put themselves in is the Uber rating. What's your Uber rating? Or did you give that person 5 stars? And that's, again, TaskRabbit was one of the go-to platforms for services, and you'd want to find a service provider that's got the most number of stars and votes. Is that model going away with the AI agents? Are you going to still upvote AI agents?
I think that one of the key functions of a marketplace to provide trust, and part of that is a quality filter. And so I think the Web 1, Web 2 methodology for quality was oftentimes ratings and reviews and scores. And I think that will probably persist, but I wonder if it maybe is less important going forward. So again, we talked about earlier, a lot of AI solutions can be outcome-based and solution-based. So it may be more of a system of, did the AI agent actually get the job done on behalf of the customer? And there may be ways to quantitatively or objectively measure that. Two, maybe the rating system evolves. It's not 5 stars. It's a thumbs up, thumbs down. Yes or no, did it happen? I think that there is probably a place for human feedback, again, especially as these agents are trained and work to improve. but I think it will likely evolve and probably going to see a lot less of the five star and a lot more of just a more quantitative measure. But I think marketplaces, and it's probably different for each marketplace. Like what works in one context maybe doesn't work in the next. So it'll be up to the marketplace founders to figure out what is right in my situation and how does it evolve in an AI world.
Yeah. A loaded question for me because I'm building an AI agent marketplace myself, and we're going to stick with the thumbs up, thumbs down. Was this agent helpful for you? Yes or no, as opposed to getting too deep into five stars or not. Just keep it very simple.
But that's cool. I didn't know that. That's great.
Still in the works. It's not out yet. But one of the challenges that you're going to have is, we're going to talk about authenticity. And there's two angles to this. So one of the challenges I see in terms of service providers are people are naturally going to become aware that, or that's not really a real picture that you're using of your croissant from your bakery. That's AI generated, or it might be your croissant, but the background, everything's AI generated, or the copy is AI generated. Is that profile still authentic? Are people going to double guess whether or not to use that because it's obviously it's not your own work. It was done by AI.
Yeah, I think this relates a little bit to my time at Eventbrite, but human connection is so core to who we are as people and human beings. And I think in a world where a lot of that humanity is being farmed out to AI agents now, people, real people, will crave a human connection and reality and authenticity, as you said. So I do think there's probably going to be a backlash. If people can tell or if people suspect that this is all AI generated, it's just not going to feel as real. And so there might be opportunities for marketplaces or other businesses to take a counter approach of, we're just not going to use that. We're going to take raw photos. If it's rough around the edges, that's fine, but it's more human. It's more real. And I think people, at least a large subset, will gravitate towards that. So it's probably an opportunity to differentiate and stand out as opposed to going with the masses that may adopt an AI only approach.
But do you think it's not going to be like a default perception now by the general public? Oh, everything's AI. All those profiles are AI. So a perfect example is OpenAI just released previously in the past month their video or their image generating capabilities. And everybody was creating these Ghibli memes.
Yeah.
But true anime fans know that the original artist, the founder of Ghibli, took immense pride that none of his artwork was generated by technology. It was all hand-drawn. And so it's like a kick in the teeth for him to see all these Ghibli knockoffs when he took so much pride in doing everything by hand and all of his artists doing all their animation by hand. And are people going to have that perception of everything's AI, everything's generated, and the people that are trying to be authentic, are they going to be the losers in this?
It's a really profound question and one that I don't know the exact answer to, but I do think it raises the question of what is real and what's not. And I've been looking for a solution from an investment lens around, are there solutions that can help to provide a watermark or authenticity or even trace like the origins of an image? Where did it come from? Who's taking accountability for it? Because I think one, deepfakes are going to be a huge problem, right? Is this real or not? You can just think through all the implications on the world stage. Two, again, is everything just fake? And what world am I in? That feels very disorienting to humanity, right? Like we're so trained over thousands and thousands of years on what is real and what is not. And when you don't know, that feels really existential and scary. Again, looking for solutions of how we combat this, I think there will be great entrepreneurs that find the solution here, but it's a big rhetorical question. And I'm curious if you have a point of view, like, how do you think that's going to play out?
Liz, you said that what popped in my head was right now, I grew up always giving people the benefit of the doubt and saying, yeah, that person's friendly or that person's being authentic, that person's being real. I think we're slowly shifting towards doubting before we give people the chance to prove us wrong. And so there definitely is, that was going to be my other line of questions, say around this authenticity is the other side of the marketplace where you're getting endorsements. You mentioned deep fakes. So you're going to have fake reviews. You're going to AI generate reviews. People are going to, and we've already seen this on Amazon, people going in and farming out different reviews from real individuals, but they're basically saying they pay for the product, but they didn't. It was shipped to them and it's just for reviews. That's just going to be done en masse now because you're able to generate AI fake reviews. So where are the watermarks? Where is that technology to help filter this out?
So I have a few thoughts. One is I think you're probably right. People just start to default to this is probably fake unless proven otherwise. And so I think there probably are opportunities for maybe like trust infrastructure companies. There could be ways. I'm a big fan of blockchain technology, but like people's identities are verified. They're qualified as a real person, and then it tracks their behavior over the web, reviews, et cetera, and maybe flags. This is a validated human, and you can see the whole chain of validation and activity. And then maybe over time, marketplaces or otherwise, they really work to boost those verified identities and their points of view and just put in the background all the fake stuff or stuff that's perceived to be fake. So that could be a solution. There are probably many other flavors, but I think you're probably right. Over time, we just get flooded with info and baseline defaults here. This is probably not legit or not authentic.
So does the responsibility fall on the LLMs, the OpenAIs, the Groks, or is it, no, it's a free market. People can create what they want, and there's an opportunity to fill that gap for entrepreneurs to come in and build those cybersecurity solutions or verification tools.
I think if you look at past platforms, there's a certain amount of, hey, you can't enable things that are illegal, or you need to have basic protections, I would say. And a big question in AI is copyright and patents. And you mentioned Studio Ghibli, like where does that author's content ownership over these knockoffs? Like where do we draw the lines? And if I think about OpenAI and their image model 4.0, I think I recently over the weekend was playing with it. I asked it to create like my kids as Super Mario Brothers characters, and it wouldn't do it. It recognized that's a copyright protected. Yeah. So clearly they're building in guardrails. Can they ever close every loophole or every edge case? No. I don't know. There will probably be new policing models. I think we're seeing lawsuits happen already that may push people who are violating those to not do it as much, but it's just going to be a constant game of whack-a-mole, I think, as this new technology just becomes pervasive, even beyond where we are today.
Yeah, because it's not just company to company, it's country to country, it's different cultural norms. Hey, like my friend Lloyd, who is my co-founder.
Yeah, I'm always great.
He's got this whole theory about like scarcity mentality. When you come from certain countries where you had nothing, you operate differently. Like when you're in North America, it's like, we've got an abundance of not just opportunities, but resources and cultural exposures and whatnot. But you're coming from a war-torn country. You had scarcity for food, for mentorship and money or whatever it is. You function differently. And so when we come into what's ethical and what isn't ethical, it's subjective. And some countries or some companies will say, no, I got to be first to market. So I don't care about having these guardrails in. Whereas some in North America with social pressure and whatnot say, no, we need to make sure that we're protecting copyright. We're making sure that we're watermarking everything that's going to be generated.
Yeah, I certainly appreciate that point. And I think it dovetails into regulation and like, what is the right level of constraint and making sure people are playing by the rules, but also acknowledging this technology is borderless, as you said. It's going to happen somewhere. And so I think making sure America and other free nations are able to innovate and the pace of innovation can maintain with the rest of the world, I think it's a fine balance and one that we're working to figure out.
Yeah, definitely have some smart people up there trying to put in the rails, find that balance. But as you said, it's a fine balance and can teeter-totter either way, day to day. All right, we're going to jump to our last clip and break away from marketplaces and talk a little bit broader strokes around the world in general.
When the pivot launched, literally this is a headline from TechCrunch with your logo in flames. That's definitely not what you want to see. It doesn't feel good. But as most big changes in a company, for one, people were passionate about the service and they were expressing their feeling of loss about the old model. But also these things tend to pass. And what we found is that the people complaining were these active task rabbits who liked the old model. What ultimately happened was the demand side that I talked about, they were much happier with the new model. And it solved the core demand side pain points. It shifted that surplus goodwill from the supply to the demand side. And ultimately, growth for the overall business reaccelerated, which was very positive for them.
That clip is obviously specifically talking about marketplaces, but we can take that at a 10,000 foot level and talk about just change in general. enterprises adopting AI obviously is a big change. Cybersecurity threats and needing, just as we talked about, needing to address deep fakes and whatnot. How are people adjusting to change in today's world?
It is pretty fascinating to watch. I've always been interested in psychology growing up, and I think that there are going to be some pretty profound shifts over the next several years. Organizations have many different points of view and people. Some people, one thing I learned in managing teams is like when change happens, everybody moves through the change curve at different speeds. And some people are probably some of our friends, like technologists super far on the cutting edge. They're already like where the rest of us are going to be someday, but it's going to take time for all of us to process. And I think a lot of people are going to go through different stages. Like oftentimes there's fear of loss leads to anger. So we're going to see some people really emotional as we go through these shifts with AI. You're going to see people make a ton of money. You're probably going to see some other people suffer a little bit more by certain jobs going away or changing dramatically. So it's just going to be this wave of change unlike anything we've ever seen. And I can't possibly predict all the outcomes, but that's kind of like the realist or maybe in some ways pessimistic point of view. I also think it's going to create tremendous opportunity. There's a lot of talk about job loss from AI, but I think there will be a ton of new professions created that don't exist today or at meaningful scale. And I could provide a few examples. Like there will be, in my opinion, many nuanced vertical based LLMs where experts will need to train those models and give constant feedback. And so I think there will be like AI trainer roles where you're responsible, you're a domain expert in an area, you're training that model and constantly giving feedback. And that job doesn't exist today. So that's one of many that will probably come out of it. And then as our economy becomes more efficient through AI, I think there will be a lot more time for people to go back and do what they do best, which is be creative, pursue passions more broadly, and still be able to make a living in different ways.
Yeah, just that change curve. When we started Launch Academy in 2012, and then we started Traction in 2014, one of the premise behind why we wanted to build these platforms was Silicon Valley is the heart of tech in the world. But these second tier and third tier markets, like Vancouver, Portugal or Dubai or wherever you might go around the world, the change curve was probably 2 years behind. Like you look at mobile, is big, and then SaaS. What we were seeing in Silicon Valley wasn't hitting the market or developers in these second tier markets until 2 years later. Now that's gotten a little bit closer and closer, but I think today still what we're seeing with happening with AI and the innovations that we're seeing out of Silicon Valley, you're not seeing it at the same pace in these other markets. And this goes back to that velocity discussion that we have and the density, but people are hitting the change curve at very different times. And so large corporations, knowing that they have to do something about AI that's coming down the pipeline, some will react faster than others, but that mentality, do you feel that mentality is there where people are more receptive to change or more receptive to adopting technologies, or is there still a big barrier for us to overcome?
I think people have come to grips with the fact that AI is real and it's here and it's going to be impactful and meaningful. And I think companies and people are open to it in a new way. I think we've gone through a phase of like, there was a period of time where boards were asking every company CEO and leadership teams, what's your AI strategy and what are you doing? And so a lot of companies were testing a bunch of things. There was a lot of test budget to be spent on AI. And so there was a period where startups were the beneficiaries of that, where they collect fees and there was a reasonable willingness to pay. Seemingly, we have seen a trend of some of that test budget starts to dry up. And again, we talked earlier about outcome-based pricing and that being a trend in AI, because partly because the test budgets are drying up a little bit. So anyways, people seem willing to adopt and try. People have come to embrace the fact that AI is here to stay and is real. And I think companies are increasingly looking to AI to solve their core problems. I think there's still a ton of questions around data privacy, threats from AI at certain companies. And so it's like a cautious, let's see. But there are more companies, like we're investors in a company called Udea, which is a legal AI company that works with mostly Fortune 500 companies. They create solutions that are very keep the data all on-prem with those providers. It doesn't feed back to the core company to be used across other customers. So it's a very enterprise first solution. I think we'll see more of those pop up in different verticals because the needs are just different. But entrepreneurs are rapidly innovating and finding the right solutions across a bunch of different areas, which is really exciting.
And you touched on jobs. There's obviously doom and gloom, AI is going to take our jobs, but there's the other side of the coin where, all right, a workforce may be readjusted down from 300 to 30. What about those 30? We talk about the 270 that lost their jobs, but we don't really talk about the 30 that are still there that are now working with AI that either are far more productive or are advancing their own skill sets because they're able to leverage AI. Any thoughts on that side of the coin?
For a long time, companies would talk about how many employees they had as like a measure of success. Oh yeah, we're now at 1,000 people. Like, those days are behind us. It is really about efficiency. And so as teams, if maybe a company that was at a scale where 10 years ago, they would have been 300 people, it's to your point, 30, that's just a different way of working. And in some ways, there are probably pros around that, right? Like, it's just more efficient. I found typically as companies get bigger and bigger, there's an increasing communication challenge. And how do you keep people moving in lockstep? I think that's a lot easier to do at a 30-person company. But there are probably downsides too. There's something really fun about being in an all hands with 300 people and like the energy. And does that exist? Or is it just different at a 30-person level? Also, diversity of thought. If it's 30 people who have very similar ways of thinking, maybe that's worse than having 300 with some varying outlier points of view. Because sometimes those outlier points of view lead to the aha on how we're going to fix this big company problem. I don't know. I think it's probably going to be a series of some things are better, some things are worse, and just having to, again, fight through that messy middle and figure it out.
I think, as I said, those two sides, like groupthink in a 30-person team could be a good thing, or it could be a bad thing because you're not getting those international perspectives of people that have come from different backgrounds to help you go as a global business.
Yeah, groupthink can also be called alignment, right? Oh, we're all aligned. No, it's actually like we're in our own echo chamber. So I don't know. We'll see how that plays out.
And one of the metrics that startups are measured against is our average recurring revenue. But is there a new metric coming out that's taken more seriously as average revenue per employee?
Yes, we're seeing that more and more. I'm working on a new investment right now where that was average revenue per employee was a key chart in their pitch deck because it was really impressive. I think there will be more companies that as the cost of AI go down, people can create a prototype and prove that there is some semblance of product market fit early without raising money or raising very little, start to get into some revenue. And then we're seeing now, I believe there will be more seed or series A rounds. It's kind of like, instead of bootstrapping, it's venture strapping. Like, they raise one round and then scale up the team to the level that they need, but then pay for more growth of headcount if they need it through revenues that come in the door. So I think there's going to be a trend of one, maybe two financing rounds early, and then a lot of self-financed growth. I think growth stage capital will be there still, but companies will probably be able to control their own destinies much greater than they have been in the past. And it's going to be interesting to see how the financing world adjusts to what I think is going to happen with company creation and scaling.
And then the other side of that coin is man hours saved. And so one of the things that we're using at OpenSport, my company, is we have a calculator and you put in how many coaches do you have that are collecting data on a daily basis? How many hours are they spending collecting that data? Then how many hours are they spending deriving insights from that data of training regimens or new training routines or injury prevention or whatnot. Data being collected, data being analyzed. And say you have five people, 10 hours a week, 2 hours per day collecting, and then 1 hour a week analyzing for results times the hourly rate of that person. You are now saving 5,000 hours or can't do the math right now, but 10,000 hours annually. Instead of firing two coaches, you're not going to fire your coaches. But those coaches can now actually do what they're trained to do. And what they love doing is actually getting in and working with the athletes as opposed to sitting behind their laptop trying to crunch all this data and tie all their different data sources together. And so that metric for us isn't just about how much more revenue are you getting. It's like how much more time are you recovering from your employees, your highly paid employees, your highly skilled employees out of this mundane day-to-day work and putting them back to what they love to do, which is working with the athletes and going out winning games.
Yeah, I love that concept of leverage. Give people leverage to do what they do best and where they're most impactful and take away the things that aren't. I think that's a great example. I think also the notion of ARR in a SaaS context of paying per number of seat licenses and you agree to a 1 year, 2 year, 3 year deal, that's declining over time. I think any more companies are charging, again, based on outcomes or solution. It's not as much on a per seat basis. It's more on what value are you delivering, and they take a fair amount on that. And company ARR is now being called as annualized revenue run rate based on the number of transactions that are happening. And entrepreneurs are experimenting with different pricing models where you maybe buy a certain number of credits or outcomes up front to give some predictability to the business. But the days of, hey, we're just going to pay per license software, I think we've peaked and it's going down.
Yeah. Usage-based pricing and outcome-based pricing are probably going to be the norm. Then do you see that 2 years, 5 years? Like, how far are we?
It's happening now. I think over the next 2 years, it's going to really take off even further. And over time, I think it's the vast majority, like 80% plus, 90% plus.
No. Brian, this has been a fascinating conversation. I think I've learned so much in the last 30, 40 minutes here. We always like to end our podcast with a call to action. What can our audience do for you? What can our audience do for DeFi VC?
Thank you, Ray, for having me. It was awesome to talk to you and really fun to be back on. The best thing is if you're an entrepreneur or building something in marketplaces or otherwise, would love to talk. We're always looking for great founders, either via referrals or reach out to us directly. My handle on X is at BM Rothenberg, and you can find me there or on our website, defi.vc.
Awesome. Thanks, Brian. This has been an awesome conversation.
Thank you, Ray. Have a great day.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of the Next Wave podcast by Traction. If you enjoyed our show, please subscribe to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/@startuptraction and give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcast and Spotify. Let's get some
traction. This episode is brought to you by Boast.ai. Each year, the US and Canadian governments give out billions of dollars in R&D tax credits and innovation incentives to fund businesses like yours. But the application process is cumbersome, prone to frustrating audits, and receiving the money can take up to 16 months. Boast.ai gets you access to research and development tax credits and innovation funding opportunities without the headache and red tape. Join thousands of North American companies leveraging Boast.ai software to maximize cashback. Check out www.boast.ai.
This episode is brought to you by Launch Academy. Launch Academy is Western Canada's main tech hub with over 6,000 entrepreneurs being incubated from over 100 different countries. Our companies have raised over $2.5 billion in funding and they come from a variety of different backgrounds from blockchain, AI, cybersecurity, quantum computing, ag tech, fintech, health tech, you name it. If you're interested in learning more, check us out at launchacademy.ca.